Mormon Stories Podcast is made possible through the financial contributions of its listeners. To keep it alive and available to future generations, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org. This interview was also recorded in high-definition video and can be viewed at mormonstories.org, on YouTube at youtube.com/mormonstories, and in iTunes as part of the podcast feed. So, 2 years after Gerald died,
right?
Goodbye, I Love You was published.
Yes.
What was that like?
Oh, it was a big. It was big. Gerald and I never discussed the idea that I would write our story, which seems weird now, but it never crossed our conversation. And it was a couple of weeks after his passing that I, being inundated with all these awful stories of young men being totally abandoned by their families and dying alone with AIDS, and knowing that my particular Mormon community was still very ignorant on the subject of homosexuality, it occurred to me that maybe I should write something. And I wrote a proposal for an article for Good Housekeeping or Red Book, Ladies Home Journal, whatever, and to shorten all this, because we need to, I was able to get an agent who very quickly sold the idea of a book to Random House. And I worked with that editor, and I went back through my diaries and was able to find a lot of very important immediate material. And I spent about a year writing the book, and then they took another year to get it published. So it came out in 86, and that was a very scary, scary time. I remember when the publicist at Random House called me and said, we're getting things in motion here, and we've had a request for an advanced copy of the book by a Deseret Book Company in Salt Lake. They want to see that. And I just about went into heart failure. I thought, I'm not ready for this. Well, what is this going to mean? And of course, I had thought through all the contingencies. And all I knew is that it was something that I had to do after I got Gerald's parents' permission and my children's, as far as they were able to be, to know what was going on, said, yes, this is something our dad would want and it will be good. So I was terrified when I thought, what's going to happen to me? You know, and my income was essentially from my Mormon audience primarily.
Because you didn't pull punches in this book. I mean, you probably did, but it's a hard-hitting book. When I read this 50 pages into it, I'm like, she updated this in a more recent version because it's too hard-hitting. It's too intense. There's no way a book like this could have been published in the 80s without serious consequences coming down on the person who wrote it. Because it doesn't condemn, but it challenges church culture, church leadership,
okay.
Mores.
John Delin, are you sitting down?
I'm ready.
So a couple of weeks later, the publicist at Random House called me back and she said, Deseret Book has ordered 1,000 copies of No More Goodbyes, and they are asking if you would do an autograph session at their store on a weekend that they're calling General Conference. And honestly, when she said that to me, I think I burst into tears. It was such a relief, and it was so moving to me. And I remember about that time I had a conversation or after with the buyer at Deseret Book, who told me that he and his wife had stayed up all night reading it in tears and knew how important it was. So, so yes, Random House put out the book. I was on all the talk shows. I was on Good Morning America, Oprah. They sent me on an eight city tour, including Salt Lake, and I did a big thing at Sunstone. It was kind of a historic moment. And but when I came to Salt Lake, and I went into the downtown Deseret bookstore for the autograph session. And when I came in, there was already a long line, and it was quiet. And each of these people who came up to have me sign the book and thanked me and hugged me, and I just knew that each one of them had such a precious, awful story. And I was just so deeply grateful that I could be there for them. And then I did Deseret Book at Orem. That's where I met Bruce Bastian, my dear, dear, dear friend. What a good man he is. And the book sold rapidly, really, really well. Now, this sounds like I'm making it up, but it's not. The person who was, I guess the buyer who was taking me around at the downtown Deseret bookstore, then or later, told me that in that first month of the release of Goodbye, I Love You, he said they sold more of that title than they had of any other title in a single month in his history with the company. And I really was not surprised at all that, because I knew of the need. I mean, I knew, as Matthew Arnold said in that poem we read, the same heart beats in every human breast. And in that so many Mormon families, this same thing was being played out in one way or another. So I was not surprised at the hunger for that people bought the book. There was maybe one bookstore who decided never again to sell any more Carolyn Pearson books because this was such an awful thing that I had done to write this. But in general, the response was so positive. And honestly, I was prepared for a kind of a minority, but yet a significant negative response. But I didn't get it. And I'm sure that there were people talking out on the fringes. Oh, da, 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 da. Can you imagine she would write that? But very little of that came to me. The letters that I received were almost all so positive and so grateful. I began to file them in separate categories just so I would know. So I had a file for Mormon gay, Mormon lesbian, non-Mormon gay, Mormon parents of, da-da-da. And, you know, the largest file that I accumulated of letters was LDS general, meaning not a parent writing to me, not a gay person, but just an ordinary Mormon person saying, I just want to thank you for helping me understand something that I have never understood before. So I'm glad to be able to tell you that's the reception that Goodbye, I Love You got.
Was it because you were protected by the fact that you had lost your husband and people aren't going to go after a widow? Or was it that everyone was excited to have a Mormon break through to a national audience and be on Oprah? What was it?
Well, no, it was because there was something really genuine and human and vulnerable. And of course, I'm sure a lot of people were sorry for me because of everything that I had to go through. But this was not just some
I'm wondering why people weren't angry.
Why they weren't angry?
Why they weren't feeling like this is No Man Knows My History Part 2, you know, Fawn Brody, like someone who's out to take the church down.
John, because it's not.
Right. But
it's not.
But sometimes that's how people interpret things.
Oh, I understand. Now, I got a call from a woman in the South who said, I have a group of Mormon ladies that we meet with all the time, and one they want me to call and ask you why you have not been excommunicated yet.
Right. Yeah.
So I'm sure that there were some of those kinds of questions. But I did not ever really feel coming toward me anything as significant as the kind of gratitude that came toward me. And that's the case to this day in everything. All of my issues, I have received so much more appreciation and gratitude than anything else.
Sure.
So the book came out and sold really well, and that opened the door for me to start receiving hundreds and hundreds of stories from gay people, from their families. And see, that's been, what, 25 years ago? So now, of course, I get emails, and almost every day there's one or more email from somebody either simply wanting to thank me for my work or needing some encouragement not to kill himself. So let me bring us
I
up
have to
to.
just say that my friend who called me this morning serendipitously said that one late night in real sadness and desperation, he emailed you quite late, and within an hour, he had received a personal response from you.
I've talked to a lot of people, and I email. I respond to every email. Oh yeah. And really, it's a shame. Well, I guess we can get into that, that we don't have more immediate help to give our gay people. So a few years ago, realizing that we were not where we need to be still on this subject and wanting to get back to my work with the theater, I wrote Facing East, story of a Mormon couple dealing with the suicide of their gay son. And fortunately, Plan B in Salt Lake, and with the financial assistance of Bruce Bastian, who underwrote their production, they staged the play in 06. And it was a wonderful event in Salt Lake. Had a lot of publicity. And the theater was filled. And it was thrilling to me to watch all these different people come in. People I could know, okay, there's a gay couple. Here's a couple of hippies with their piercings and their black and their orange hair and all that. Here's a couple in their sacrament meeting clothing. All these, this variety of people came to the play. And during the play, there would not be a sound. And the whole thing is at the graveyard, at the site, the grave site of, in at the cemetery of the young man who has just taken his life. Who, of course, was patterned after so many people whose bits of stories I knew. And of course, the most public suicide, as has been Stuart Mattis. I didn't meet him. I have not met his parents. And he was not really the main person I had in mind in writing Facing East, especially when I talk about why this young man took his life on the temple ground. I was thinking, I tell his story in No More Goodbyes, my dear friend Brad Adams, who, you know, just like you have said, this young man do everything right. He joined the church. That was going to cure him. He went on a mission. That was going to cure him. He did all these faithful things. Nothing cured him. He went to his bishop in Provo. This was quite some time ago. Once a week for a full year to get a blessing. And all that blessing did was to stop him from feeling anything for anybody. And at the end of that year, he knew he was never going to change. And he said to me, I knew I was going to the lowest kingdom anyway. I'd just as well go now. He gathered all the pills he could. He went to the Provo Temple, sat on a bench there, thinking, well, this is not a political, in the play, you think it's going to be a political statement against the church. No, it's not. I quoted my friend exactly, saying, I knew there would be kind angels hovering around that place that would take me in. Now, that should just break our hearts, because everybody should have been those kind angels for him. And he took his pills, and he went unconscious and evidently walked, and he was discovered the next morning and was in a coma for 2 weeks. And then he went to San Francisco, and that's where I met him. I met him at an affirmation banquet. I sat by him, and he said, Sister, after I spoke, he said, Sister Pearson, do you know what makes me sadder than anything. To know that in the next life, I want to be where you and Heavenly Father and Jesus are. And to know that I can never be there just breaks my heart. And I said, Brett, are you kidding me? You think you know and you think everybody else knows where people are going to be in the next world? He said, oh, I wish I had a friend like you. I said, Brett, I'll be your friend. So Brad and I became friends, and he was my first computer person that helped me learn, and Bruce Bastian gave me my first computer. And but that's, Brad is who I was thinking of when I wrote that awful little bit in there that should just break all of our hearts. The Deseret News gave Facing East its Best Drama of the Year award, and then it had a limited off-Broadway run and a San Francisco run. And that's been performed by a variety of universities, community theaters around and about, most recently in Rochester, New York, where the state president there purchased one of the performances to have his state members come in, after which he and the area president who were there headed a fireside about the subject and invoking everyone to become more aware and more compassionate. And so that's Facing East. But then I wanted to have, it occurred to me that I needed to, and hadn't had a book on this subject since Goodbye, I Love You. And so I quickly put together and self-published No More Goodbyes, which has proven to be a really important book to a lot of people. Telling, kind of bringing us up to date where we are now, is told primarily from a Mormon point of view, has bad stories, suicide stories, ill-fated marriage stories, and a lot of good stories of families letting nothing come between them and their gay kids. And I love that that book has been out in this really critical time that we have been through, you know, where Prop 8 has thrown us into more intense battle over this whole thing. That book, with its invitational tone and insistence that we are going to move to a better place on this subject, that has been very important for a lot of people. There are really so many thrilling stories that I could tell you about how No More Goodbyes has helped families and gay people, and the play too. I'm remembering one of the performances in Salt Lake City. We often had a talk back with the cast and crew and the audience afterwards. And on this occasion, right over to this side was a young woman who stood up and said, I'm a lesbian. This is my partner. We love each other. We want to be together. I know my mother will never accept this. When is this play going to come back? Because I want so much to have my mother come and see this. And she started to cry. And I left the front of the stage, and I walked over, and I gave her a hug. And I said, this is from the cast and crew, and I think from everybody in this audience. And that her mother loves her in the best way that she can, even not understanding this issue. And anyway, we talked then and after the play a little bit. But when the play was in New York, I was checking my email, and there was an email whose heading said, thank you for saving my partner's life. And it was from the young woman who was with that young woman saying so-and-so had seriously, truly been moving toward ending her life. And that moment in the theater of seeing the play and receiving my hug and hearing the conversation around, she felt that she could go on. And those are the kinds of stories that I am so fortunate to get so often from people. And it's an enormous privilege to be able to work on this frontier.
Was it difficult? Has it been difficult to receive so much positive, affirming gratitude and praise for your work, for Goodbye, I Love You, for Facing East, for other things? And to feel so much support from church members, and then to have Proposition 8 happen.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a disaster. And having lived through Proposition 22, in the year 2000, which I tell about somewhere in No More Goodbyes, that when my former bishop and home preacher came around canvassing, as he was assigned to do, and what did I tell him at that moment? Something clever. Oh, no. I said, listen, David. It's not that the brethren don't want gay men to marry. They want them to marry me. And they want them to marry my daughter. And that's not okay. And when you go to sleep tonight, I would like you to think, would you like one of our beautiful young LDS gay men, fresh off his mission, to come and marry one of your two daughters? So, and as I say that, and as I tell that little story in No More Goodbyes, I do not mean truly that the brethren want them, these marriages, to take place. They have made a statement, theoretically, that we're not encouraging, that this is not a remedy for this problem. But that means very little to somebody who believes that his eternal life is in jeopardy and that he's faithful enough to make it happen. So anyway, we're way behind where we need to be, wherever that is, we're way behind. So yes, that was Proposition 22. And then in 08, and the letter that was about to be read over the pulpit came onto the internet the week prior. And for some reason, I feel obligated to do what I can. If there's some way that I can, at least I have to express what I feel. And so prior to that letter being read, I made 4 phone calls to church headquarters. 2 to public relations offices, 1 in California, 1 in Salt Lake City. 2 to general authorities offices. And I just identified myself and said, I'm just calling to express my grief at what is about to happen in California. I need to underline for you that you will be receiving the worst public relations of your lifetime. You will be dividing more families than you have any idea. You will be alienating neighbor from neighbor. You will not receive one bit of benefit from what's about to happen. And I had good conversations with whoever it was that of the 2 PR people that I spoke to. And I wasn't able to speak to the 2 general authorities, but I gave their secretaries, I said, I want you to write this down to convey to them. And I said to them, if they should have a moment to speak to me, I would really like that. To my surprise, one of these general authorities did call me back. And we had a long and very respectful and profitable conversation. And it essentially was me speaking and him listening and replying. And I would like to have on record pretty much one of the major things that I said to him at that time. I said, just a few months ago, I watched the movie Amazing Grace, which is the story of the ending of the slave trade in Great Britain. And I sat there thinking, why was it so hard for them? Why couldn't they see you just don't do that? You don't take another human being and have half of these people die on a boat and then use them the rest of their life. You don't do that. But that's where human consciousness was at that point in history. And I said, how dare we even ever think that we are at the end point of human consciousness, that we understand everything about the human family. We're just at another point along the way. And I said, when we Mormons get really historically clear on our whole journey, we will have a long list of things that we are very, very proud of. And I can make that list as well as anybody alive. And then we're going to have another list of things we are not very proud of. I said, we will always, of course, be uncomfortable with the Mountain Meadows Massacre. We will always be uncomfortable with polygamy. We will always be uncomfortable with our history with racism. And I said, I believe that we will be uncomfortable that at a given time in history, when we could, when our church could have taken a leadership role in issues that we conveniently called women's issues, such as bringing back the concept of the divine part of the Godhead, of the feminine part of the divine in the Godhead, that rather than doing that, we chose to work actively against it. But I said, I believe our greatest shame is going to be reserved for how we have treated our gay brothers and sisters, because I don't think there was one black man who ever took his life over how we made him feel in not being able to hold priesthood in our church. And neither I nor any of my women friends have taken our lives over issues that were and are deeply important to us, being not only marginalized but actively worked against. However, hundreds, and I do mean hundreds, of our best, most beautiful LDS gay men, some women, but mostly men, have taken their lives because we have made them feel so hopeless and so worthless. And when we get a real bead on that, our shame will be enormous. And our conversation went on, and I said some other things. But so here came Proposition 8. And it did. It just went across the land like a disastrous tornado and left nothing in its wake but pain and sadness and divided families and divided wards. And, you know, there are way too many instances of, you know, awful things that happened along the way in that. The sister of a good friend of mine, who was a Stake Relief Society president in Southern California, put it this way. And she was one of the stalwart soldiers. She said, because of Prop 8, she has lost the friendship of the family to her left, the family to her right. She said, I feel like the generals came in from Salt Lake, told us to go into battle, and then left. Left the bodies on the field, left us to figure out what to do about it. That's the statement from this Relief Society president, whom I know. So, yes, it was total disaster. And yes, as we know, the PR that the church has received over that has been so horrendous. I always, in everything, have to say, okay, everything moves us forward in one way or another. Terrible things move us forward in one way or another. And may it be so for this. May it, you know, have been sufficiently shocking that it's been a wake-up call. And it has been to a lot of people. I am not privy to conversations among the general authorities. A couple of years ago, I signed individually and sent to every one of them a copy of No More Goodbyes. I didn't expect to hear from any of them, but I got three letters of thank you, saying that they were reading it, they were learning, and that they were appreciative of the work that I have done on this very important, sensitive subject. So that's... And good things, of course, do come out of that. Now, I will tell you for a little bit about the good people in my own stake. And it may come as a surprise to anybody watching this podcast that I have never been hauled into a church court. I have never been treated with anything except not just tolerance, but real appreciation by my local church leaders, my bishops, my stake presidents. I have been treated so well by all of those people, and I have had really fine leaders. At this moment, my stake, the Oakland stake, is led by three of the best men I think exist on the planet. And they have been aware of the damage. They have seen one of their wards actually pretty much ripped into. And they concluded that there were things that they could do, you know, without being commanded in all things from the top. And so these three really fine men last year went around to each ward in the stake and gave a presentation to the Combined Priesthood and Relief Society on better understanding and loving our gay brothers and sisters. And they use scripture, and they use some good quotations from the leading brethren in Salt Lake, and talked about that people do not choose their sexuality, and some of the problems that exist, the suicides, and that families must keep close their gay children, and that all of us must look with kindness and love and compassion on our gay brothers and sisters, whatever their choices are. And these were all beautiful presentations and have created a lot of tremendous goodwill in my stake. A lot of families have felt a little safer coming back to church. And a friend of mine told me the story of the next week in a high priest meeting, one of the most conservative brethren in the ward saying, "I need to apologize to all the men in this room. When I went home last week after hearing this presentation, I was a little troubled on my thought. But I had to do some praying and I had to do some studying, and I've concluded that I have been wrong in some ways. And so I'm apologizing to every man here for some things I've said in the past." I could tell you a lot of good stories like that, of just enlightenment and kindness and education of that have come as a result of all that. So it is my hope that some of the awful things can stimulate some of the good things, because, as you know, this is one of the major things of society and church that's up on the table now for that we have to examine, like it or not. And we have to do it. And we just better get more busily about it and try to do it through the eyes of Christ.
Let's turn for a minute to some practical sharing of experience or advice or wisdom or anything that you have in your arsenal to help people who are in the thick of trying to figure out how to navigate their life. So I'm going to give you four or five or six different people in certain stations in this dilemma and ask if you have any experiences, stories, advice, insight to share as they're trying to navigate their way. So the first would be a young man or woman, let's say 18, 19, 20, who's on the precipice of deciding whether or not to go down the road of the Mormon path. Do I go on a mission, which then is going to lead to probably temple marriage? Is there a place for me in the church? Should I do what the others have done and just sort of dive in as a huge leap of faith that there's a place for me in this church? Or do I just bail because only sadness awaits at the other end?
Yeah. I have never said to anybody on any occasion, "I know exactly what you ought to do, and it's this." But I do receive a lot of emails of the general type that you're expressing. And I would never say, "Oh, don't go on a mission. That's just going to compound the problem." The only thing I consistently say to young people like that who do email me is, I say, I want you to believe in yourself before you believe in anything else. That's maybe the most consistent thing I say to anybody who contacts me. Because so many of these, especially these young gay people who have tried and tried and tried to change and to do things the way that the church asks them to do and find that they are unable to take everything on themselves, and they are totally unworthy of anything, and often have just the tremendous personality problems of the psyche and a darkness of the spirit that they don't feel themselves to be worthy of being often. And to these young people, I absolutely say, put away your belief in anything that is going to tell you that you are unworthy of life. And you know what? When Stuart Mattis was consulting with his bishop before he took his life, and his bishop wisely said, Stuart, if it's a choice between your life and the church, take your life and run. Run with it. Leave the church. I never say to anybody, oh, obviously you ought to leave the church. But I do say, believe in yourself before you believe in anything else.
But isn't that the opposite of how we might interpret Christ's message? He said, lose your life and you will find it. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and its righteousness, and all things will be added unto you. I tend to agree with you, but how do you reconcile that with the scripture?
Well, I don't know that the best interpretation of that is to whittle away at everything you are so that there's nothing left. One of the dilemmas of the model Mormon mother is to give little pieces of herself everywhere, without filling her own bucket and saying, okay, I'm supposed to lose my life. Everybody else's life counts except mine. And that doesn't lead to anybody's good. And it would not lead to anybody's good in the cases that we're speaking of here. People have to have a good sense of who they are before they can give their life away to anybody.
Okay. The next role, 22, 23-year-old man or woman, knows they're gay, mission didn't fix it. Found someone who they think might be a suitable companion and is trying to decide, do I marry a member of the opposite sex even though I know I'm gay?
I have never encouraged anybody to marry a member of the opposite sex if they know that they are gay. I say, from my experience, I cannot possibly urge you to do that.
Have you had associates who have done that and made it work? Do you know people who have been able to figure that out happily?
Well, I know marriages that have survived. The risk is just too great. I mean, for me to say, oh yeah, you know, I think you have a really good chance of making this marriage work. I would never say absolutely. Well, yes, I have said. I mean, women have contacted, oh, I'm so in love with my boyfriend and he's gay, but we think we can really make it work. I cannot say, sure, you're strong enough to go ahead and do it. I have to say, from my experience of myself and everybody that I have seen, the risk is too great. I would tell you, do not enter into that marriage.
Not even with prayer and fasting and faith and scripture reading and devotion to the church?
Well, of course, in addition to that, I always would say to everybody, do you know what? You have inside of you your own connection to God. And you listen to me, you listen to your neighbor, you listen to your family, you listen to the brethren, you listen to your bishop, you listen to everybody that you think has something to give you on this. And then you listen to your own connection to God. That's what I would say and what I do say.
But in your experience, the risk
is
too
large. In my experience, the risk is too large to go into that kind of a marriage.
And you would never suggest your straight daughter or son to marry a gay partner?
I think not. And we'll just take a moment to say that my dear, wonderful daughter, Emily, in her own particular insanity that she will perhaps discuss with you sometime, my brilliant, wonderful daughter, who is right now doing really, really well, did enter into such a marriage, believing that they were being called upon to show that it can be done, that her parents didn't do it right, reparative therapy can make this work. Well, it didn't, and the disaster is beyond enormous. So that's enough of that. Next question. Who? A couple who now are married and have children. Yeah, is that your next
yes,
question?
Thank you. So you're a 35, 40-year-old man or woman who tried to make it work. They've been through it all, prayer, fasting, bishopric, beautiful children. They've white-knuckled it, and something inside them is just still calling out for the companionship of...
Right. And again, I would not presume to say, oh, this is what you should do. I have said over and over and over in a case like that, either way you turn, there's going to be a large sacrifice. You have to make the decision of which sacrifice you want to live with. Try to think 5 years down the road, how would you feel about either one of these? On your deathbed, how would you feel about either one of these? And I'm not saying that for every person it's going to be the very same answer. In a particular case where the man is older and the children are all grown, and I don't know. There have been cases where I have really said, I think you'd be giving up too much to end your marriage. I remember talking to a young man. He was fairly young then. They had, I think, 8 children. One was severely disabled. He was in he was a gay man. He had just white-knuckled it all the way through. He was in love with a man. I remember just saying to him, of the two sacrifices that you have got to decide between here, I am hoping that you will give yourself to your family. And, you know, there are cases where the husband and wife can, you know, come to a pretty equitable agreement that both of us in a long term will be better off if we do separate, and we can hopefully manage to both of us do parenting well. There's no good answer to that. And truly, except in the rarest of cases, do I say, I really feel this is the best thing for you. I say, you know, you have to, with the best inspiration that you are personally entitled to, and in consultation with your spouse, figure out what is in the long run going to work. But that's very, very tough.
What would you say to the man who's decided that he just need, or the woman that's decided they do need to leave their spouse? What advice would you give them about navigating a post-marriage gay?
Well, if that decision has been made, I can only encourage somebody to do it with as much consideration and as much grace as possible. And I often recommend that they give one or both of these books to their spouse to be able to talk over all of the issues. If somebody has made the decision to leave, they just have to do it as best they can. And often, there is no way to do any of this without pain.
What if they're fearful? They don't want to become promiscuous. They want to find true love. You know, they want to basically have the Mormon life, just with a man or woman of their dreams.
There are so many who want that. And the things being as they are, cannot have it.
What do you mean?
The church will not accept them.
Oh.
No, if they want to have the Mormon life, and here is my gay partner and me, and we are going to come to church and hold hands in sacrament meeting and whatever, that is currently not allowed. But there are a lot of Mormon gay people who love the Mormon lifestyle, who have strong feelings about their commitment to everything they have learned at church. And if they had their first choice, they would love to be able to be a gay couple within the structure of the Mormon church. Okay, so let me tell you about this young man who, well, he emailed me, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks ago. Short email, just said, thank you so much for your work. I am going through this incredible Gethsemane. Please say a prayer for me, or whatever he said. I always respond to these emails, and once in a while I make a phone call. And he had his phone number there, so I called him. And we had a good long phone conversation. He had just joined the church a month prior. He had come from somewhere in the East. And he had always been gay, I'd known that he was gay, and his parents were fine with it, and there wasn't any big religious thing where he grew up. But so he joined the church, and he loved how he felt at church. And he'd already fallen in love with a Mormon gay man, and they had established a relationship. That gay man's parents were horrified. And they ended their physical relationship, but they remained really good friends. And this young man said to me that he wanted more than anything to be able to be in the church with his man that he loves more than anybody he's ever loved in his life. But he said, I don't think that's going to happen. And I asked him if he had some support, where he is, if he had people to talk to, people to help. And I said, you know, in Salt Lake, there are non-Mormon gay kinds of support systems if you need them. And then he sort of started to cry. And he said, I know, but there's too much promiscuity just going on in just the gay world in general. And that's not what I want. I don't want that. I want the way I feel when I'm in church. I want the church, and I want this man that I'm in love with. And I don't think the church is going to let me have them both.
You know, I just have to jump in. There are a lot of religious people who will say, I fear the person that I would have become without the gospel in my life. That without the gospel, who knows what types of horrible things I might have done. And I think that sometimes straight people are really eager to point the finger of scorn at gay people and the quote gay lifestyle and all the debauchery and orgies and promiscuity that goes on, realizing that these people don't have the benefit of a moral religious community.
Well, yes. And let's acknowledge that there are now and have been really all along a certain number of gay couples who have been able to have long-term faithful relationships. Today, more than before. But certainly, in some way, we have taken these people, thrown them into the gutter, and then blamed them for getting dirty in the gutter. You know, there are a lot of religious people, Mormons included, who are more comfortable with the idea of gay people being in bathhouses than they are of gay people being in established relationships that have either the term marriage or whatever to validate that relationship. This wonderful lesbian woman that I know, as she came to a meeting at my home where there were also some local church leaders there, and we were talking about the various things we need to talk about on this, she said, you know, it is this brilliant, she's an attorney, very well spoken, very mild and really irresistible. She said, I find it so strange that the most, and she married her partner during the time that it was legal in California, and they are together raising two boys. She said, I find it so strange that the most conservative thing that the gay community has ever tried to do is the thing that has caused them the most hatred from straight people, and that is to ask to be married.
Yeah. Yeah, we'd rather keep them illegitimate.
We would. We would. But, you know, we're at this historical point right now where there's everything is just churning and churning and churning. Like the British Parliament was, where they were trying to figure out, oh, we can't stop the slave trade. That would be the end of our economy. Or when the people were, we can't let women vote. That would be the end of the family. Please, there are sermon after sermon after sermon of that time where it would be the end of the family if women were given the right to vote. So here we are now in this other historical time where it's going to be the end of civilization if we should give authentic credibility to gay relationships. And John, I do not pretend that I know exactly where everybody ought to be at the end of the road, where the general authorities need to be when, in decades to come, everything is finally figured out on this. But boy, I am here to say, and it is my obligation to say, we are not where we need to be.
So for the young, for the man or woman who was married, had kids, decided they're going to leave their spouse, and they realize that they just, there's no place for them in the church. Is there hope? I mean, you've alluded to it. Is there hope for them to find that partner and to live a meaningful, fulfilled, safe, healthy life? Should
of
they?
Of course.
Or is that just a fantasy? I mean, Gerald didn't find it.
Oh, no, no, he did not. And there are plenty who do not. My dear, there are plenty of us heterosexual people who do not find what we think we deserve. And quadruple the difficulty for gay people, really, just because of how what society has traditionally allowed them or not. But do I know any healthy gay relationships? Of course I do.
Long term, even?
Yes.
Monogamous?
Yes. I know. I don't know if you finished reading No More Goodbyes, but there are a number of... Okay, you may like this story. I tell there my friend, his name is Sakoki. He took that name from, I think it was Tahiti that he went on a mission. That was his mission name, and he used it the rest of his life, Sakoki. He and his partner, Richard, who had their... They met in the Los Angeles Gay Men's Chorus. Richard was Methodist, I think, Lutheran. Sakoki's long history of Mormon. His stake patriarch father, Relief Society president mother, all the family came to the commitment ceremony about, I don't know, 15, 18 years ago of Richard and Sakoki, these two beautiful men who deeply love each other. They have since married legally when it was available in California. Just, I think, prior to when I was doing No More Goodbyes, and I contacted Sakoki again after I had met him a long, long, long time ago. And I said, Sakoki, are you and Richard still together? He said, oh, of course we are. Why do you ask that? They had been together about 18 years to that point. And he and Richard were going to come up to Northern California. And so they dropped in to see me, and I fed them, and we talked and had a wonderful, wonderful time. And they were just so sweet together and had this little moment of somebody disagreed on something, and they were just so sweet about it. And I just adore these two men. So that was that evening. But then in a couple of days after that, I was visiting with a friend of mine in my ward, who's telling me about her in-laws, who they're both Mormon temple workers, but they arrange their temple schedule so they never have to see each other in the temple because they hate each other so much. Okay, so I'm looking at that couple, and I'm looking at Richard and Sakoki, and I'm saying, where is true love here? Where is kindness and joy and delight in being with each other? So, yes, I know. And you're going to interview somebody else who is in the book there in Oakland. Who's our biology professor?
Bill Bradshaw.
I tell the story in there of Brett Bradshaw and his partner who live in Oakland. Well, they're married now, and they are raising this darling little girl. They have been together for quite a long time. They are deeply happy, have a rich relationship. Guy Berryessa and Trey, his partner, they are... I tell of them adopting this little girl who happened to be a little black baby who was a drug baby, and they stayed with her in intensive care for a while they were able to adopt her. She is this delicious girl who's now about 10 or 12. Yes, I see these little families who deserve to be honored.
And for that middle-aged man or woman or young or whoever who's fearful that they might end up like Gerald versus Sakoki, any tips or tricks or advice you've learned to help them end up more like Sakoki?
No, only listen to the best that is in you. You know, maybe the first step that all of us need to take in so many of these issues that we deal with is to make a decision that the answers are inside of us, that we listen to everybody else out here, everybody. And then we know that finally we have within us the relationship with our heavenly parents and the inner wisdom of our soul, that we can know what path is really best for us, and not best in any kind of immediate gratification kind of sense, but a path that is best in being truest to who we believe ourselves really to be, and that feels to be a path of love and joy and being able to be the most honorable person that we can be. And everybody has that within them. They don't need me to tell them anything except to remind them that that is inside of them.
Okay. A couple more quick ones. The young man who's decided that he can't marry a heterosexual spouse, but he or she cannot leave the church, and thus has decided they're going to make their life as a sacrifice on the altar to God and to live without intimacy. Any advice or thoughts for that young man or woman?
No.
Same thing?
There are, I'm thinking of several that I know. A dear man that I just saw the other day that I've known for years and years and years, has never, totally gay, has never had a romantic embrace from either a man or a woman. And he has done everything the church's way. And he feels that he's made the best decisions for himself, for what he needed. And he's held, you know, reasonably high positions in the stake. And people probably know that maybe he's gay, but everybody loves him anyway, and nobody brings that up. There are cases like this everywhere, and it's not my business to say that this is a wasted life. This person has had a rich life of relationships with a lot of family and a lot of friends and a lot of contribution. And the Salt Lake Tribune did an article about what my stake did that I just explained a little while ago. And it profiled one of the members who is an out gay man who has made the decision to leave his gay partner and come back to the church. He was interviewed. He works in a responsible position in the church, and that is the life that he has chosen, and he deserves to be respected for that life.
Some gay advocates, I don't know how to describe them, when we talk about an issue like this, they get really animated and upset that it turns people into a shell of a man or a woman. It deprives them of something that's as fundamental as the air we might breathe or the water we drink, and that it's just a cruel thing to ask of somebody. Is there...
Well, that's a really difficult, you know, that's sort of the basic knot of this, all of these threads that we're talking about here. It comes down to this knot of, are we going to give people permission or encourage people to follow what they feel in this particular way? I'm a little bit, what I'm trying to get at, I think, here is that certainly one sexuality is a very deep part of who all of us are. It's not necessarily the only part, but it is a very profoundly deep part. And I would feel that for most people, and you know, there are always exceptions, but for most people, that is and will continue to be an aspect of themselves that they want to celebrate and that they want to find a relationship in which that truly is celebrated. And we know, as we watch history move forward, I don't believe any of us expect people to go back in the closet. That is not the way history moves. And from what I'm observing, there will be more and more gay people within our church and without who are feeling, as has not happened in many, you know, way, way decades past, but is happening now, that they can discover who they feel themselves authentically to be and find a way for that to be respected in a relationship that feels right to them. We are going to see that happening more and more for our LDS people as well as others. And that is the challenge in the church of how is the church going to respond to that.
And is it fair to say that just like you would tell a young couple who's considering marriage that the odds are against them, that you wouldn't recommend the high probability of success? Although it's up to them.
To a mixed marriage couple?
Yes.
Gay and straight?
Yeah. So just like you admitted that the odds are against them,
uh-huh.
would you tell a young single gay person that the odds of ending up fulfilled and joyful without ever sharing intimacy with anyone, that the odds are against them as well?
No. I mean, everybody, it's a gamble for everybody to navigate this whole thing of relationships. But each individual is, it, you know, very, very different story. And I would have to say, as I have said, that I certainly know very happy heterosexual couples. I know happy homosexual couples. And I can only say, you know within yourself, with the direction that you get from God, the path that you should take. Not to say that there's going that all that there will always be a happy pot of gold at the end of whatever journey. Plenty of relationships of whatever kind are just not going to make it.
Gay or not.
Yeah. But for everybody, that draw seems to be almost universal. To attempt to find a relationship where emotionally and physically there can be a celebration together. That's not going to end. Everybody, almost everybody, has that within them. And so it's a messy business. All these paths are pretty messy and fraught with landmines. But we travel them. And we need to support each other as best we can while we travel them.
How about to the parents who have found out their kid's gay? What's the advice to them? It's pretty simple, I guess.
Do not for a moment withdraw your love from this child. Remember that this child is the same little baby you loved when he was in your arms, the same high school student that you were proud of when he brought home his report card, the same college student that did well in whatever, is so charming and good and such a good part of your family. You just remember he is the same, he or she are the same person they were before you have this new piece of information of another thing about them. Now, I'm telling you, this is where our society, and I'm saying our Mormon society, fails so miserably. Okay, just 2 days ago, a woman, people approached me all the time to say, oh, Sister Pearson, can I tell you, what do you think? So her sister and the sister's husband were just given the information that their 20-something-year-old son is gay. They are both just a basket case. The mother came to Utah, doesn't want to go home. She's just, can do nothing but just cry. The father has recently been put in as a stake president. Upon hearing about his son being gay, he said, I'm going to have to resign from my stake president. I said, what? What? But that's where many people still are. I have failed with my family.
Not resign from stake presidency to support the child. Resign because this must mean they were a failure as a parent and aren't fit to be a church leader.
Here's the response of this. I mentioned him in No More Goodbyes, this young man that I've told him I would put him on my visiting teaching list. And I call him every month. Some years ago, his parents pretty much disowned him. And his sister repeated to him a conversation with the mother saying, well, I guess we should be better to so-and-so, but he's not going to be with us in the next life anyway. That's an unusual extreme. But in between that extreme and the story, such as I tell in there, where the parents, upon hearing that their son is gay, a letter from him, take the next plane to fly back to hold him and tell him that nothing will ever change in the way they love him. Between that extreme and this other extreme, there is all this wide arena where there's a lot of pain, way too much pain. You know, and in that conversation I mentioned a little bit ago where I conversed with this particular general authority, and I said, you know, we Mormons are so big on preparedness. I've got wheat in my garage. Most of us have something. Few of us will be wiped out by a fire or a flood. But a predictable number. If we say maybe close to 5% are essentially, okay, that means what? 5% parent of, 5% mother of, a couple of siblings. Every family, if you get out to a cousin, aunt, uncle, every family has at least one gay person in it. And what do we give these parents when they find out that they have a gay child? To some of them, it is worse than if they had a fire or a flood. But they reach into the little backpack that we've given them. And maybe they pull out an old copy of The Miracle of Forgiveness, which Elder Kimball said later he wished he had written differently. But maybe they have that. And that's maybe all they have. And to this particular general authority said, no, Sister Pearson, that is something I can take and talk to the other brethren about. We need to prepare our families with better information about all this. So anyway, it's a very, I know that history moves slowly, but there are moments in history where things have to just happen. And people have to unitedly stand up and say, no more.
What about to the young man or woman that's thinking about taking their life? What would you tell them?
I would say, your life is precious. Your life is supposed to be lived here and now, no matter what anybody has made you feel about your life, whether it's your parents, whether it's your church, whether it's your interpretation of Scripture, no matter what it is, please put that away. You can do, well, okay, here's something I say frequently. You can help the cause of making things better for gay people so much more if you will stay here and shine than if you take your life and go. And there's a chapter in there where I speak on the phone to somebody who has his suicide date picked out. And I called him. And I as I write there, I said, at first I was sympathetic and then I got mad. And I said, don't you dare do this to me. Don't you dare do this to the rest of the team. We're on this team together trying to figure out a better way for gay people and their families to exist in this society. And for you to take the coward's way out, what would that do to your children? That'd give them one more reason to think of you as a loser. I said, the only thing you are called to do is to stay in this life and be the best human being you can be and shine as brightly as you can shine. And you know what? He did. That suicide, I visited with him when I next came to Utah. And on his suicide date, I called him on the phone and he answered. And no, he's still on the team. And we speak from time to time and he's still on the team. So I guess I would say to everybody, don't let anything or anybody dictate the value of your life. You know, I know that so far, this in July, there have been 3 LDS gay suicides in Utah, one of which had a fair amount of publicity. That's a terrible thing. And people who do that are not in their right mind at the moment. We know that. And we know that they have been fed lies about who they are that have put them in that position. We have to stop feeding them those lies and give them more nourishment of who they really, really are. Open our arms to them more. And then just say, we need you. We need you here to help make things better. Stick around and work with us.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to discuss it with others, please check us out online at mormonstories.org. If you want to find other friends, family members, former missionary companions, or ward members who approach Mormonism like you, consider adding me, John DeLynn, as your Facebook friend. This may seem like a strange idea, but many of my closest friends have discovered that they are not alone in their thoughts or feelings or family or even a work situation through discovering mutual Facebook friends. Finally, to keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider a donation at mormonstories.org. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Still